when Croatia becomes a member of the European Union. So we've organised a number of events over this six-month period, and we're particularly pleased to have a strong Croatian presence at the London Book Fair and have tonight this event here at Keats House. Few things I have to say before we get on with the real event. First is to say that all the books, our local independent bookshop, has copies of Rinka and Dasha's books for sale here if you'd like to buy them after the event. Another is to say that we've managed to confuse some people, at least, by saying that this is both a free event and that the tickets are £5. The answer is, well, Nicholas is the diplomat here. The answer is,
I hope you have the money though.
The answer is, at the end of the event, if you'd like to make a £5 donation, we would much appreciate it. The money will go directly to Keats Library. I think you all know that libraries have been struggling, and the library here is now an independent one, and so a small contribution from us would be much appreciated. If you would like to make a £5 contribution, then Susie will be happy to
open hands.
So, having said that, we hope your mobiles are turned off. I'll hand you over to Nicholas, who will tell you more about what's going to happen. Nicholas has had a distinguished diplomatic career, which of course features most prominently as an ambassador in Croatia. So I'll hand you over to Nicholas. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. Welcome, everyone. Distinguished is perhaps overstating, but I've had a very enjoyable one in my career, and particularly in my time in Croatia. It was a very good time to be there. I went in 2000, and I left in 2004. Just
in time.
Just in time for the transition from what we might describe as a rather more authoritarian regime to a coalition that led on and applied for EU membership. And of course, this year, Croatia joined the EU. I was also able to maintain some professional links with Croatia when I was the director of the British Association for Central and Eastern Europe for 5 years, from 2004 to 2009. So it's a particular pleasure for me to be here this evening. Before we get into the real meat of the evening, can I just describe the format that's been agreed? Our three distinguished guests will each speak, read, describe their philosophy, perhaps, for about 10 minutes each, in order, or less or more, whatever you have. There'll be time for a couple of questions from the audience, perhaps to each of the guests, and then we will break, and there'll be the opportunity to talk individually, personally, with the authors, and to buy books, which are on sale here, if you haven't already read them. And I'm sure we're going to have an immensely stimulating and enjoyable evening. They are not in conversation with me. I think it would be impertinent for me to play that role. I'm a simple administrator, not a literary critic. The questions will mainly come from you or with comments. As you know, our guests are Marinka Kosic, Josip Novakovic, and Dasha Drndić. And we didn't draw straws on who would speak first, but it's been agreed that Marinka will go first. And he, as you will see from the notes that you received about this, his novel, A Handful of Sand, is the focus of this evening's discussion for him. He won the inaugural prize for Croatian, Bosnian, Montenegrin literature in 2009. one with his novel Someone Else, at the Selimovic Prize. And I think on that note, I will hand over to you, if I may, with one question from me, and then we take it from there. I just wonder, your second novel was, which won the prize, was took the form of six separate characters, six movements, some people describe it as. The Handful of Sand is more of a duet between a love duet between two people, man and a woman. And I just wonder, is this a form that particularly you find particularly convenient, that attracts you to write in that manner, or is this just reverting or moving on from that?
Well, thank you for your question, but before I answer it, I would like to thank you all for coming. It was really a great surprise for me to see so much interest in our literature, which I actually expected you didn't even think that it existed, but obviously some of you do know that we do have people who write. We would also like to have some people who read in Croatia, but this is a much more difficult matter these days. So we are glad to find some readers finally. And you actually put me in a difficult position with your question. This is something I was afraid to happen, that I would have to answer about something that is in this book. And if I write books, this is actually to forget about things that are inside them. So I was hoping not to have to think about it again. But luckily, these editors, they're intelligent and helpful people, so they do write things on the backs of the book. So I just now, I remember that there is a trip. It is about a couple of people who
you can read it to them.
Who meet at a certain point, and
you can read it.
No, but then I think it would be more convenient to give the book to the editor to read. I think the second novel of mine was more of a construction. It was actually, I was so pretentious to imitate, try to imitate Bach, a suit by Bach, so to compose it on the basis of six movements that create a Baroque musical piece. And this was basically a story of a lost opportunity, as my editor says. It's about two people who, after living in a desert for a while, having spent the whole of their lives without anything important and significant and intense, meet for just a brief moment and then spend several moments of love, passion, and everything else that goes with it, and then realize that they simply cannot keep it, and that it's too much, that they are so used to what they know of themselves that they simply surrender it to nothingness, and nothingness is what follows. This is a book about a very brief moment in life that somehow, maybe, perhaps, might happen to someone, and maybe even not. And then some of us, if it does happen, are not able to keep it. So it happens. And
it's like sand going through.
This was the basic and very banal metaphor behind it. I couldn't think of anything more intelligent. So it was very personal for me. And if I
what
wrote
do you mean personal? It happened to you?
So, which I said, it was somehow important that I get rid of it.
Uh-huh.
Whereas some other of my books were constructed as I wanted to tell a story. I wanted to write a book. This is the book that wanted to be written.
If the mother it.
All right.
Could I just have a supplementary question to that? Is it written about every man, or is it really embedded in Croatia and Croatian experiences? Does it have a wider...
I think it's not possible to live any story or life or a moment without being very firmly attached to a specific particular context. And the context is what makes us. And how much of modern Croatia and how much of being Croatian is in me, I don't know. I never thought of myself as being a Croatian author of writing Croatian literature. I don't think literature has a nationality, but literature certainly does draw from context and from the moment, from the specific moment. And while being a very specific love story about a very specific moment in my character's life, it is also a story that describes a specific setting, social setting, and I also put a lot of societal things which do have a relation to what we call transition society and after-war atmosphere in Croatia in this particular moment. So I don't think I would have written it without being very important to me, but I was thinking of how it reflects a specific particular atmosphere in society at that particular time. Yes.
Any questions from the floor at this moment?
Susie.
You talked about the. I know you work as an editor, and also a book editor for a company in Zagreb, and you were quite scathing about the publishing industry in the book. Is that have you changed your opinion since that time?
I've changed publishers.
Okay.
I've had 5 different publishers for 6 novels. I think it could answer your question.
As long as you're happy with the English one, that's my main concern.
You're so far my best English.
Translator is here in the audience. Do you not
want to say something?
Stand up.
Okay.
Would you
like
to? Should we?
Well, how will you read?
You said that you thought literature didn't have boundaries. At the same time, you said that context is important, which is absolutely true. I mean, you obviously had exposure to Anglo-Saxon literature as well as Central European. I mean, do you think there are differences in the way the body of literature has developed and how literature is approached?
No, it's absolutely the same everywhere.
So how do you compare a writer like George Orwell with a Central European writer? Is there a George Orwell equivalent?
No, what I meant actually is
Zamyatin. With we.
What
is now a we.
What I actually meant is that nowadays, even more than before, I think we are all exposed to world literature, whereas 100 years ago, you could easily speak of national mentality reflected through a work of art. When nowadays, I think we are just we share much more of international context. So, speaking of a national approach in literature is simply something not convenient, I think, in this respect. But I think we could. This is a general point of view, which is not my preference. But I think we could. Think about nationalities through literature. I think this would be one powerful instrument for analysis of national mentalities. If you look chronologically through world literature, but I think nowadays we simply belong to the same core of writing.
I just want to move to that point. Which is a smaller, typical group of readers who can actually understand the language, or whether that actually
influences the way you write if you're thinking about trying to reach outside of that particular linguistic group.
One thing that really impressed me when I opened this book, and something I should have done at the beginning, is to thank my translator, Will Firth, who really... Will Firth, are you listening? Because I'm thanking. So he was so punctual. He was so full of questions about everything. And he made a really great job. So much that when I opened the book for the first time, I thought, my God, this looks almost like a real book now. what I'm trying to say is, it's difficult. I don't think I should say such things, but it's difficult to think of yourself as a serious writer when you're just condemned to such a small audience. Being translated into English means that my book can be read anywhere in the world. It's quite a different thing. It's somehow, even if it has nothing to do with reality, I mean, it's a piece of text. It does look more serious. And we think of ourselves as a small community. I think it's a serious factor that it's difficult to think of big topics, of big themes. Somehow, I realize that abroad, people don't expect to find very serious literature in these areas, in these small, ridiculously small countries. So people must somehow author, somehow they must integrate this outside opinion, and they tend to pick smaller topics. I think there's a reality in that. So I think we communicate with an idea of ourselves which is already as something very limited. These are concepts that we have to fight, actually. And in the same line of thought, there are prejudices that we have to fight. For example, when we present ourselves outside the Croatian borders, immediately we're confronted to this expectation of, oh, this is going to be about war in ex-Yugoslavia. So you are from the Balkans. So we are going to talk about slaughters and mass rape and bloodshed and stuff like that. Somehow it happens that some books do not talk about these things. And then there's disappointment, probably. This is a constant negotiation with this image of ourselves that we do have. They do exist. It's our reality. We somehow come from ex-Yugoslavia. We don't come from modern Croatia. We come from ex-Yugoslavia. Especially in the... Yeah.
Yeah. We do.
Okay. See?
Ex-Yugoslavia is older than modern Croatia, isn't it? Yeah?
Yeah, but this one is more modern.
Well, we could discuss that also.
Yeah. But again, what can you write about these things? How can you write novels about going to the beach? This is not a topic, and it has to be about war.
Could I just interrupt there? I have to tell a story about Mrs. Thatcher, which is relevant to this. The various ambassadors throughout former Yugoslavia, the successor states, one of the ambassadors to Belgrade told me that Mrs. Thatcher in the 1980s visited Belgrade, and he thought he'd show her the tourist industry. And he took her out and took all these people on the beach, lying down, sleeping, enjoying themselves. And she said to him, "But what do they do?" And he then explained they were German. But perhaps this is the moment for Josef Novakovic. If you wanted to read or say something about your philosophy and your latest book.
He won't read?
Were you going to read?
Well, I was waiting for it.
He was preparing.
You told me you didn't want to read.
No.
Preparing himself.
You read now.
He found the fragment. He was rehearsing. No.
I'm very pleased.
I have to do my routine now, because I'm so prepared for it. Now I'm going to trick you, and on the basis of this excerpt, you're going to think that it's an interesting book and an optimistic one, but it's very depressing, dark, and boring.
Don't say that; they won't buy the book. People don't like depressing books.
What was the page again?
179, I think.
Thank you. All right. This is just when they met. It's two of them, a boy and a girl. And just very briefly after the first encounter, it goes approximately like this. But I didn't write it. I mean... This is Will Perth, he translated. I unlock the door and push it open, and still on the doorstep, without turning on the light, we are seized by a fever and reach for the other body, which immediately refuses to remain foreign, and in it we recognize the other half of ourselves. Like a switch, this sets off a trembling in both of us, and our two halves inflame it further, stirring and fanning the fire in each other. Our halves understand each other perfectly in their own language, unearthed in regions of our being which have long languished in ignorance. We had no idea that we possessed them, and they us. Our body takes us over completely, lifting us out of oblivion into its arms with love swift and sudden, and we would instantly surrender it all we have, and that is now so much, more than can fit into the sum of our earthly existence minus this instant. It is one immense microcosm. It merits that we stay in it forever and ban other forms of existence, more of which arrive to vie with each other ever more frantically and destructively, which to choose, perhaps the one where it becomes certain, irreversible, that our lips will adhere. It already exceeds all my hopes, the horizon of my life's combined expectations, to think that the closeness of someone's lips would bloom in me into such splendor and riot, but they don't stop at all. They really do touch me. All of me and all at once, I tremble from head to toe from one single touch of that tiny, downy body, because it answers every tremble like a mirror with a trembling of its own. And that mirror shows how much I've missed what you are, what now bedews your lips. I press myself into them and they absorb me whole. All that remains of us is a common mouth, a source and an orifice at the same time. All else is swept away by the darkness revolving around us. We're buffeted by a whirlpool and are at the same time its heated, delirious heart, freed of mental grime. And our fingers and mouths conquer centimeter after centimeter, more of that naked throbbing. Wherever I touch is terribly vibrant, it burns, renders, dissolves, and draws me into itself. It can't stand clothes a second longer, and we cast them off like feathers. It is inconceivable to ever wear them again, such an insult to the skin. It's unimaginable to touch anything except your skin. Yours and mine have been tailor-made to press up to each other, envelop each other and enter every recess to grind each other's presence into the grooves. All the separation we've endured now gushes forth, rushes to recover what is ours. All of life has marathoned and molded us for this moment with Spartan austerity for disruption. Whatever we experienced before was only for comparison with this, for the sake of euphoria at discovering the original. Bare skin takes on the role of lungs, inhaling the heavenly manna from the other's skin, drinking it without breath, with elemental passion, as if possessed, pedantically, I sample one morsel after another, only to return obsessively to the epicenters, tirelessly drawing from the chambers of relish, from your breasts and armpits and groin and all the folds, furrows, openings, cavities and dark spaces. I penetrate, press, plumb, probe, plow. You tremble beneath me and rise up, feet flush against me, squirming, moaning, gasping, striving to break through the membrane which hampers complete osmosis, the fusion of the sexes, of shorelines and skylines. Will stay uplifted in the stratosphere, the eddying elements will blindly seethe in every segment of ourselves and hide in the astral expanses from all that is perishable and one iota less than intense, integral, hypnotic and boundlessly arousing. That's all we can do. It's the only place. There's no further than this. Ah. Excuse me for being so short, because they said only one sentence, so...
we're in the... Thank you very much. We'll come back to the general questions. We're in the Keats house, and of course Keats gave up medicine, studied medicine in order to write. And in Norfolk and Novakovic, we have someone who also, I believe, studied medicine.
I studied medicine also.
We're all safe, and we're in the right place. But Josip's book, Infidelity, Stories of War and Lust, is his third collection of short stories. It's been nominated for the Booker International Prize, which will be announced, the winner will be announced next month, and we wish you very well with that. Josip was born in Croatia. He studied there, then moved to the United States for Vassar and Yale, and in doing so, and Cleveland, and in doing so, I think it's fair to say you were following, returning in some ways to your family roots, that your grandparents or great-grandparents had emigrated there, and then your mother returned. I just wondered whether you would like to say something about your latest book, about the short stories, or earlier works, and how you see your work progressing.
Okay, I'll get to it, but I would like to address this thing about war and other topics. You know, when I was a kid in Darovar, there were all these old guys with sticks and medals talking about the war, and I thought, my God, they're really old. And now I go to Croatia, and if I talk about the war to younger people, you know, it was in 91, 22 years ago, they look at me, oh my God, this guy is really old, you know. I think the war is over, and there are so many other topics, so on. Yet, you know, I did end up writing about the war, and I didn't want to. I was always disgusted by war novels and war books. And when I started writing, I wrote fantasy and was setting my stories in the States. But then when the war broke out, I went to see what was going on there as a journalist, but I was a terrible journalist. So and I realized I had to write fiction about it. For example, my brother-in-law was about 200 meters away from the howitzer lines of Serbs in Vinkovci, and his house had a couple of really big ones, big howitzer holes, and shrapnel all over the house. And my sister had the shrapnel in her liver, and she's still green and yellow. I never completely recovered from it. And so I went and interviewed him as well, how it was during the war, and I got nothing out of it. He instead read the Bible to me and preached. And I said, I still don't know what it was like for him. Why did he stay? He was the only man on the block. And so to understand that, or somebody like him, and then later I moved away from him completely, it became fantasy. I wrote a story about a religious freak, a beekeeper, who, despite all the dangers, remains and just prays. and relies on God, and in the meantime, well, he's all right as long as his bees are not touched, anyway, I don't want to tell you the whole plot there, but fiction helped me understand him much better than my journalism. I had another example. I went to Blatze, which was a refugee camp outside of Vukovar, and I talked to... I actually didn't do it properly. I didn't have proper press credentials, so he didn't let me in, so I couldn't interview people. But he said, I can talk to you. And he said that he was in Vukovar hospital when the Serb soldiers came in, dragged 270 people and shot them in the cornfields, and they insulted him, and he said, I don't know what I would do if I saw one of those guys somewhere, let's say on the train. And I said, wow, that is something interesting. And I didn't talk to him much. We actually didn't seem to have the right chemistry, and was still pissed that he wouldn't let me in to talk to the people. So later I thought, well, that would be really interesting to see him and one of those Serb soldiers meet someone, maybe put them in Las Vegas in a fighting ring, see how they fight. Well, of course, it couldn't be done. Or if they met casually somewhere on the train, how would you arrange that? Well, in fiction, I could imagine it. And so I didn't even know the guy, anything about him, so it had to become fiction. I imagined him running into his former tormentor and eventually killing him, and only to discover that he killed the wrong guy, because suddenly everybody looks like the guy he killed, and he goes crazy. But anyway, I still thought that entering into the fictional world to understand this guy and his thirst for revenge, was an important exploration, which I could do better through imagination than through interviewing people. And I make a point that if everybody sought revenge for the wrongs done to him or to his kin, the real war would only start now. You know, let's look at the Albanians with the blood revenge. It's amazing that not more people are being killed. There is no revenge, really. We rely on the Hague International Tribunal for Justice, and it's kind of a feeble justice if a mass murderer gets 20 years in a luxury prison. It doesn't really satisfy the thirst for revenge. So in that story and some others, I explore the topic of... because it's a dream that many people have, the revenge. And I do think that fiction is sort of a form of expressionism. It's like not like a dream, but a nightmare. You know, in a nightmare, a lot of awful things happen, but they're somewhere in us, and they need expression. So I do express some of those things in fiction. But now I've moved away from the war deliberately. I don't want to write about Croatia or Bosnia or anywhere there. Or Serbia, written about Serbia. I lived in Serbia for a year. I studied medicine in Novi Sad, actually. And I've written a novel about Russia, and I'm revising it. An absurdist novel. And I'll come back to the short story again. I think it's the most natural form for me, because though it may appear that I'm very talkative, I think all I have to say, I can say. And lucky for you, I think in 25 minutes...
Questions? Comments?
I just wanted to say that it was rather interesting that you left Croatia and yet felt compelled to write about the war, and you stayed in Croatia and didn't want to write about the war. I don't know if I'm reading anything into that, but that's...
Well, you need to understand. I think my primary impulse in writing fiction is to gain understanding. I was brought up as a Baptist, highly religious, so... I did write a few stories of people of different faiths, and people who lose faith, people who gain faith. There was an obsession for a while, and so the war, definitely did need to be understood, and I wrote in my novel about it as well, and I took an absurdist take. I always admired Joseph Heller, Catch-22, and Old Soldier Schweik before that, and then particularly Slaughterhouse-5, the Kurt Vonnegut, where the whole thing is extremely absurd, you know. So, and the great thing about that I mean, Vonnegut always jokes, but and he summarized his education. He was studying anthropology at the University of Chicago. He said, I learned that all the people were the same. That there were no civilized and uncivilized people. And I also learned that there were no beautiful or disgusting people. That everybody was the same. And I thought, wow, that's a wonderful summary of anthropology. Nobody's smelly. Everybody's the same. So even after this novel about the horrors of burning 120,000 old people and children in Dresden, he doesn't pass judgment. He still says, and so it goes, and so it goes. It's like this natural force of history and human stupidity and viciousness that just keeps going. So he, in a way, judges all of us, not just one particular group. And I think that's a fantastic approach to it, not just to say, oh, they're more guilty than we are, and therefore we need to kill them sooner or later. And so in a way, I took that approach as well. And I also want to have fun with the grim stuff as well.
Yeah, absolutely, in order to digest it in some way.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, how do you judge Nazism? I mean, are you so benevolent?
Yeah, also? Nazism... Well, he wrote about Nazism that... I'm not the judge. I judge it and say it's a horrifying thing, you know. But on the other hand, I lived in the United States during Bush era, and I could see how people were beaten into meekishness. Suddenly there was a sensation of terror that we were all being listened to. Our phones were bugged, our internet was penetrated by it. And so if you mentioned the word bomb or whatever, immediately your email would be pulled out and the police would read it. And so nobody, even you know, our dignified politicians like Hillary Clinton, they all voted for the war against Iraq on flimsy evidence. And I could see that the country was just being swung into this nationalistic, after 9/11, nationalistic frenzy and stupidity and basically Nazism. You know? So my God, see, it can happen to anybody, even to the nation that was judging the Nazis most and most vigorously. So I think Vonnegut got it right. And so it goes. This is a natural force that can engulf us, you know. And with the Germans, I wasn't there. But I think that also what happens with war on a large scale is you have... not everybody's a volunteer. You have conscripts. And you have two camps of prisoners of war fighting each other, as was the case between the Russians and the Germans. Most of the Russian conscripts didn't really want to be there. They were terrified, and when they were young, and the Germans at the time were getting younger and younger, so you had 16-year-olds who, you know, they were prisoners. And so what I liked about Nuremberg trials is that only the officers were being judged, and the high-ranking ones who really spread this reign of terror and who organized this prison camps for others and for their own people. And so, you know, we can talk about it for 30 years, I believe, the blame is not all that simple. Of course, the Nazi party and the top party, I think execution was the absolute best way to go. You know, I come from the States and there we still believe in execution. So we do believe in some kind of judgment. I'm not sure how good it is, actually. But I do believe that those guys, the top of the Nazi party, deserved execution. And I do believe that some people who, in a way, I can't say caused, but led to demagoguery and so on, perpetrated war in the former Yugoslavia, they also deserved to be executed rather than to be talked to in The Hague, given the opportunity to display their wit. You know, Milosevic was incredibly witty, so he actually had fun there, making a circus out of it. Luckily, medically he died, you know. So, but anyway, I've talked too much, but...
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you something? There was a lot of writing before the war happened in Yugoslavia. I remember books which are actually instigating people of war, digging differences. They never got judged. They are never actually accused. There was a lot of journalists who were perpetrated, as for me, as much perpetrators as a lot of actual physical type objectives. They never got even mentioned. And this goes on, and that's why we are always occupied with wars. And
yeah, you know, it depends on what kind of journalism. I think that it's true that the Second World War story needed to be dug into more deeply and not just a black and white picture of it. And the problem was that the journalists who were digging up the old bones also interpreted those bones in their way and excited people in Croatia to feel they were that they were the victims rather than the victimizers. And, I agree with you that there was a lot of bad journalism that made people excitable, and then a guy like Milosevic could step in and create a frenzy. It is very complex. Of course, we should not forget soccer. You know, the passions of hooligans. The war started. It's not the cause, but it started at Dinamo Stadium, where you know Crvena Zvezda and Dinamo played, and the hooligans started fighting each other. The special forces were brought in to subdue them, and about 100 people were injured. Then the Croatians felt that the police was mostly Serbian and protecting the Serbian fans and hooligans and attacking them. And that was an oversimplification too, but at any rate, it was received like that, and it really excited people in Croatia. So they were manipulable by Tuđman to shriek for independence and more vigorously than before. And again, we can talk about this for a long time, but how to judge everybody individually, and you can first judge yourself, see whether you are a nationalist, a patriot, and start from there. It's funny how in the States, when I got there, patriotism was considered a virtue. When I was in Yugoslavia, Croatian patriotism, for example, was considered to be a form of Nazism. You know, so you were not supposed to be a proud Croatian, which was also a problem. But on the other hand, I do agree that patriotism is extremely dangerous, but American patriotism is probably even more dangerous than any other patriotisms, because there's so much power, firepower there. And so there are all these elements. But in soccer, so in soccer, you're a soccer fan, and rooting for Croatia, really passionately against other national clubs, and you can easily see that there is a germ of danger there. You know, it's like having tuberculosis since we're in Keith's house. So we need some streptomycin for that. And what is it? Obviously, the best streptomycin is good economy. We need to, if people were gainfully employed and happy, and they could all go have a vacation on Hvar. The strange thing is that the Croatians cannot afford to go to Hvar because it's so expensive. So if Croatians could go to Hvar, if Serbs could go to Hvar, Bosnians and so on, if they could go many other places in a great economy, you know, they might not need to express their anger and frustration in soccer as fans. But it is there, and I'm a fan. You know, I know I have these dangerous tendencies in me too, and I have to judge myself first and then others, you know.
And now you live in Canada, and yeah. I didn't know about Canadian patriotism, but you've got the two cultures there as well, in a way, two parallel cultures.
The Quebecois and the English culture in Montreal, it's a real rift. At first it didn't seem to me that serious, but it is not all that pleasant.
I think, perhaps, Asha, if I don't know whether you want to read or want to say something about your work first, I know you have
there's this cliche that women talk a lot. I'm going to talk less than these two.
but first, I'm going to say, I'm sure everyone knows your very distinguished record, but you have written numerous books, novels, literary criticism, many radio plays for which you have won prizes in Berlin, Barcelona and in Belgrade, but Trieste is long listed now for another prize for the Independent
Short
Fiction.
Short.
It gets better and better, and it will get even better. So, Would you like to say something about that? Or do you want to read?
About the shortlist? About what, the shortlist?
About whatever you want, or what this is.
Well, now they brought up this question of war. This book is about the Second World War, but I did not write it with the idea of investigating the Holocaust and Nazism. It was written a little bit after all this combating occurred in Croatia and in Bosnia, and my idea was, my wish was that the people who would read it, but as Marinko said, people don't read a lot in Croatia, would sort of be able to make some parallels, because during the Tudjman era, there were many elements of fascism. Maybe fascism is even a weak word, but there were many elements of fascism and of this ressentiment of the puppet state of Croatia during the Second World War, and you could draw many parallels to that period. And I was hoping that the readers could sort of make a connection and see how elements of fascism are always present in, I don't know how, democratic societies. We could discuss what democratic societies are. But even in the so-called most democratic societies, you have elements of fascism. And I think it is our duty. I mean, it would be nice if we could recognize these elements of fascism and speak against them, sort of speak up. There is this saying, in some respects it is true, that there is this saying about the famous Croatian silence. Croatia in some... Now I have this echo of a friend of mine saying, don't talk against your country when you're abroad. But, I mean, you know, you can't hide anything nowadays.
Well, especially if the country is paying for you to be here.
Well, those are remnants of socialist Yugoslavia. You know, when you went abroad, you were supposed to report to the embassy or the consulate and say, I'm here, you know. I don't know why. Would they track you, or would they put someone to follow you? I don't know, but I have this... well, never mind. Everybody knows that. I mean, you know, we're connected. We're all connected, so one cannot hide anything. So, what was I saying? Well, this echo, see, it disturbed me. what was I saying?
Not talking against your country.
Yeah, well, those were tough times. And as Josip says, nothing is black and white. There are nuances. But there are, in my opinion, there are things that one cannot... should not negotiate with or about, how you say. It is there are some things that cannot be relativized, and that is fascism and or Nazism. That is something that you cannot say yes, but no. It's just not for me. So this, in a way, it is a book about the Second World War. But I was wishing. People would sort of connect to what was happening in the 90s. Because besides the fact that Croatia was defending itself from an aggressor, the Serbian aggressor, there were, in my opinion, necessary moves made by, for example, by introducing the kuna, which was introduced during 1941, during this puppet state of... And all other, bringing back some Ustaše, some bringing back to Croatia, those were, they served just for sort of manipulating the citizens, the population, and sort of building up this defensive attitude, this rage towards the aggressor. I think maybe I'm wrong, but I think that the war could have been evaded. How it was nicely done in the Czech Republic and in Slovakia, so it could have been. Somebody somewhere needed this war.
Thank you.
So, I'm not a historian, but... So, what else?
I'm just going to comment that there's so many contemporary themes as well, parallels in your book. And you talk about stolen children, adopted children, and
yeah,
that's the controversy I'm seeing in Argentina at the present moment. And
well, there are, like, when they talk about this book and then they start describing the story, I really, in a way, I think that we should sort of change our views on literature, on some kinds of literature. There need not be a story all the time. There need not be a plot. We need not reject literature, all literature that is fragmented. My idea of literature, and that's how I write, which does not mean that other kinds of writings are not acceptable or cannot be very good, extremely good. But my view of literature is the fragment. I think, and in spite of the fact that literature is not a copy of reality, it is a transformation, some kind of transformation of reality. I think that fragmented literature is very realistic because our lives are fragmented. We live fragments. We don't live a continuum. Our lives are, I see our lives like something like a patchwork with sewn in pieces, fragments, and sometimes they tear off, and those are these turbulent moments in our lives when these patches come off. So there's no need to be for a story that has a beginning, a high point, and then an end, and then you, like Dickens, you write the end at the end. You know, that is not, that's a fairy tale. Okay, we do need fairy tales sometimes also, but so when people ask me what this book is about, I prefer telling them the themes that I wanted to talk about. And one of the themes is identity, because in these past 20 years in Croatia, so much has been said about identity. And of course, there is not one single, none of us have one single identity. We're a mixture of identities. Of course, the more we move around, the more contacts we have, the more our one single identity becomes fragile. So, but during this nationalistic euphoria in Croatia, not only in Croatia, it was maybe even worse in Serbia, but I live in Croatia, so I'm talking about, here's the echo again. There was this insistence on the one national, in my opinion, archaic identity. You know, immediately I would see these old women by an open fireplace with dark, with black scarves and you know, knitting. So there was, I tried, that's why the book is set on the borderline among three countries. There's Slovenia, Croatia, and Italy, where cultures meet, languages meet, merge, mix, and history does its all. Does its nasty job. So what identities do we have there? And then when I try to introduce this Lebensborn subject, I don't know how much you know about this Lebensborn theme. The Nazis, Himmler built these houses for breeding Aryans, where these mothers could have their Aryan children, but there were not enough Aryan children born, so they were abducted. The Nazis stole some 250,000 Aryan-looking children, mostly from Eastern Europe, mostly from Poland. Some of them were from former Yugoslavia also. Blonde, blue-eyed, and so on, and they would select them. Those who passed the selection were trained as went to schools were trained. Others were sent for adoption. Those who did not pass the selection were exterminated. And then what happened after the war, the Red Cross and the International Tracing Agency tried to find their natural parents. Some 50,000 children were returned to their parents, and here the trouble begins. In the 90s, these people, they were 60 years old already, started, the truth came out. And now they started to question, these questions appeared. Who are we? They were brought up mostly as Germans. They loved their German parents. They had their other names. And somebody comes 60 years later and says, no, you're not this, your origins are Polish. Polish is your language, or Slovenian is your language. And there's this big trauma arising, like a big wave inside of them. And they don't know who they are. So who are we? What are we? Are we that which we think we are? Are we what they tell us we are? So this was in spite of the fact that the subject itself is horrible, but I wanted it somehow to connect to this euphoria, hysteria about identity in today. And then there's another theme that I think is relevant today, and that theme of bystanders, or these silent observers who do not have this urge to react and who just are focused on their own lives and do not, like those three monkeys, they do not want to hear, to see, or to say what's happening around them. So that would be the third theme. So boundaries, identity, and silence. So that's how I would define the book. And then inside are little fragments.
Does anyone want to ask
I remember we went to one of the presentations here in London maybe a year ago, and there was another aspect of the book which I found extremely interesting, where you were listing all the names of people that disappeared, and then you told the audience to tear out those pages, and you made a metaphor between the society and the book becoming unstable when part of society disappears. I thought it was extremely enlightening.
Yeah, thank you. That's the Croatian edition. Of course, it cost a little bit more to do it, and we did it. But yes, the idea was those. There are 9,000 names in the middle of the book of people who were taken away to concentration camps from Italy and from the Italian from the countries occupied by Italy. They were not only Jews; they were gypsies, they were partisans, and so on. And we perforated those pages so that that whoever found his or her name or surname of someone familiar could tear the page out. And the idea was, I have this idea of making sort of interactive books. I would like the reader to participate, to do something with the book. There's one of our editors. In Belgrade, he's a very meticulous and he's very pedantic, and he never, if there's something that's, if the book does not look as if it were new, you know, he throws it away. See, he never touches anything in the book. But I think that one should, you know, live with the book, squeeze it, write on it, tear pages out, do something, be with the book. So, and the idea was that when you tear out these 100 pages, the whole book becomes unstable, and you know it starts wiggling. So it's like when you eliminate a part of society, be they Jews or Serbs or Croats or Albanians, and the society is not the same any longer. So. I would like to have books with little pockets inside, with little envelopes where you could have. Nobody wants to do it. It's expensive.
It's expensive.
Yeah. And, so where you could cut. They have these beautiful children's books, but they are done in China. They're published in China, where little Chinese children's fingers do that. You have to glue it into every copy, you know, for nothing. Probably it's exploitation of. of children's labor. So I would be ready to glue these things in every copy, but it would be nice really to have little secrets, little envelopes with secrets, with little coming, I mean, because...
Well, there was a romance, epistolary romance...